Greetings and anti-Catharan tribulations, my hyper-parabolic listeners, and welcome to this May 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this indecently nefarious science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome, everyone. Let's just get started here. First, I have a comment about soda causing Alzheimer's. What am I referring to? Well, some of you may have read this, probably in regular newspapers or on the net somewhere. So two studies came out at the end of April, and both studies came out of the same research lab at Boston University School of Medicine. One was published in the medical journal Stroke, and it found that the consumption of artificially sweetened beverages was associated with a higher risk of stroke and dementia, including Alzheimer's. The second study was published in the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia, and it found that higher consumption of sugary beverages was associated with markers for preclinical Alzheimer's disease. These studies were both performed using the same method, which was looking at clinical data from a large population of people in New England over the last 50 years or so. And this is the so-called Framingham Heart Study data. Based on statistics of who drank soda, diet and otherwise, and who eventually got dementia, the studies show positive correlations. Ugh. Frankly, if I had been a reviewer of this paper, I would have rejected it out of hand, but I tend to be nasty about these things. The study did not prove that artificial sweeteners cause stroke, Alzheimer's, or any type of dementia. In fact, this kind of study design can't prove causation at all. To be fair, the authors were careful to say that the study was, quote, not able to prove cause and effect and only shows a trend among one group of people, unquote. And by the way, that was mostly white people. Many news articles in the popular press, however, didn't reflect this. The idiots in the popular press came to their own rather pathetically stupid conclusions. The researchers studied nearly 2,000 men and women ages 45 and older for stroke and about 1,500 people over the age of 60 for dementia. They tracked how much and what kinds of soda the subjects were drinking, and they monitored their health for a decade. The study determined that drinking sugary beverages was not associated with stroke or dementia, but it found that for people who drank one artificially sweetened soda a day, the risk of stroke or dementia was nearly three times higher than it was for people who consumed less than one soda per week. The problem with the finding? Well, it's important to bear in mind that drinkers of sugary sodas may have died from other causes, such as heart disease and complications of diabetes, and that's why they don't even show up in the results section as victims of stroke and dementia. This phenomenon is called survival bias. Not mentioning it can be misleading and confuse the issue. In other studies performed by the same researchers, people who drank sugary drinks were found to have a smaller brain volume, as well as smaller hippocampuses, which are crucial to memory. In that study, people who drank sugary sodas were more likely to have memory problems. This study emphasizes, both studies emphasize relative risk of stroke and dementia in people who drink diet sodas or sugary sodas. The problem with using relative risk is that it can make the likelihood of something happening seem much larger than it actually is. Relative risk does not tell you the actual likelihood that something will happen to you. That is called absolute risk. An absolute risk tells you the actual risk of developing a disease. Where the relative risk says the risk of dementia and stroke is three times higher in one group, the absolute risk says the actual likelihood of developing stroke and dementia is actually quite low. Probably 3% suffered a stroke and 5% suffered dementia. The researchers who performed the study say that their results call for more research on health effects of artificial sweeteners. Of course they do. They want more grants, to do more research, to get more grants. In the meantime, dude, chillax, have some agua. That's always a good option, you know? All right, now that I've gotten the BS about our diets out of the way, let's look at something a little more serious. I've been told for a decade by my lovely wife and others, don't drink diet soda, that's just going to make you fat. My immediate response is, how is diet soda going to make you fat? Of course, the reply that I get is that a whole bunch of studies say that people who drink diet sodas gain weight. Of course, a lot of those studies are done on folks who are already desperately trying to lose weight. I am not sure the diet soda is really doing the damage here. It might be the pecan pie or the triple servings of ice cream, but there are a whole bunch of diet sweeteners out there, and they each have a different chemical structure. Although I suspect most of them are pretty benign and do not affect weight. Well, a reliable study has finally come out that at least one type of artificial sweetener could be a problem. New evidence in the Proceedings of the National Academy this month from a research study led by investigators at Cornell University, Braunschweig University, and the University of Luxembourg has provided data that contradicts long-standing assumptions that the sugar alcohol erythritol is not metabolized in the body. The article is entitled, quote, erythritol is a pentose phosphate pathway metabolite and associated with adiposity gain in young adults, unquote. How's that for a title? Erythritol is a sugar alcohol that occurs naturally in a whole bunch of foods, including pears and watermelons. But in recent years, it's increasingly become a common ingredient in low-calorie foods as a replacement for sugar. It's about 60 to 70% of Swedish sucrose, yet it's generally considered non-caloric and doesn't seem to affect blood sugar. In the current study, however, the investigators identified metabolic genetic markers associated with weight gain and increase in fat mass in young adults during the transition to college life. Researchers found the students who gained weight and abdominal fat over the course of the year had a 15-fold higher blood content of erythritol at the start of the year compared with their counterparts who were stable or lost weight and fat mass over the academic year. Dr. Patricia Cassano's paper stated, quote, blood samples and physical measurements were collected in the first 3 days on campus and at the end of the year. We found about 75% of the student population studied experiences weight gain during transition. With the finding of a previously unrecognized metabolism of glucose to erythritol, and given the erythritol weight gain association, further research is needed to understand whether and how this pathway contributes to weight gain risk in young adults, unquote. Next story. Pain. We've finally got a major breakthrough in our understanding of pain. Dr. Stephen Waxman of Yale recently published a paper in which he described a single gene that may be able to control human levels of pain. If that's true, Waxman may have found the holy grail of being able to reduce a great deal of human agony. Waxman studied a family where 16 cousins, aunts, and uncles all suffered from erythromyalgia, also called Burning Man syndrome, in which you constantly feel as if your skin is literally on fire, even though it's not. Waxman sequenced their genes and found that there was a faulty gene called NaV1.7. Now, NaV1.7 is a neural transporter gene that can be found in the brain. It's a protein channel that's found in membranes of nerve cells and thought to control the triggering of pain nerves. Waxman tracked how these channels from the affected man-on-fire victims responded to stimuli. The results not only demonstrated that the mutations made the NaV1.7 channels more likely to open. What that means is that harmless stimuli often triggered feelings of pain, but also showed that when those channels opened, they did so for longer, amplifying the feelings of discomfort. It's a breakthrough that Waxman has spent his entire life working toward. He states, quote, we now have a fully functioning link from NaV1.7 to pain, unquote. That meant that if his team could somehow regulate or even turn off the NaV1.7 channel, they could regulate or even turn off how we experience certain kinds of pain. In order to nail down how important the NaV1.7 gene is, Waxman tracked down and studied 12 families from around the world who have insensitivity to pain, which is exactly the opposite of the man on fire syndrome. With members of this family, you could literally set fire to a limb, or they could break an arm, and they would barely break a sweat because they wouldn't even notice. That, I think that was the plot to a TV show, wasn't it? And a comic, Painkiller Jane. Anyway, Waxman found that the NaV1.7 protein is completely inactive in this Painkiller Jane group. Waxman states, quote, "This single channel, when it is non-functioning in a human being, renders them unable to understand or feel any form of pain. If we could develop a new drug that could somehow mimic this condition and inhibit the NaV1.7 channel to partially replicate that absence of pain, it could relieve people's pain without any of the side effects of opioids," unquote. If you've been listening to this podcast long enough, then you know that it's rare for biology to deliver such a seamless positive-negative effect within a single gene. In the man-on-fire patients, one mutation leads to a hyperactive NaV1.7 channel, which causes extreme discomfort and constant pain. And in those with the Painkiller Jane insensitivity to pain, a different mutation leads to an inactive NaV1.7 channel, which results in total numbness to the aches and pains that we all feel. It's a very clean result. Now, Waxman and the companies Amgen and Pfizer and Xenon Pharmaceutical Company, they've all been looking for a blocker that would shut off or at least turn down the faucet on NaV1.7 without affecting the body's other 8 sodium channels. If you block NaV1.4, for example, you might block muscle movement. Blocking NaV1.5 can inhibit the heart and keep that from beating. Blocking NaV1.6 might impact the brain and cause double vision or confusion or loss of balance or seizures. One by one, these companies and Waxman are experimenting with thousands of combinations until they get a hit, a compound that blocks up or plugs up 1.7 without any major side effects. Waxman says, quote, "At least a half dozen companies are trying to develop sodium channel blockers that preferentially or selectively block 1.7. And while obstacles remain, we are trying very hard to create compounds that will allow some pain to register without cutting it off altogether." Just how badly do we need Waxman's pain breakthrough? Well, the next story on opioid addiction tells us. At the May 17th meeting for the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine in Orlando, Florida, Dr. Kit Delgado presented data from a study that suggests that about 7% of emergency room patients got sent home with a prescription for potentially addictive painkillers, even with minor scrapes and abrasions. And the more pills prescribed, the greater the chance the prescription would be refilled, raising concerns about continued use. Delgado stated, quote, "State officials in New Jersey recently enacted a law limiting first-time prescriptions to a 5-day supply, and other states should consider similar restrictions. The bottom line is that we need to do our best not to expose people to opioids, and if we do, start with the smallest quantity possible," unquote. Previous research has found that the more opioids, such as hydrocodone or oxycodone, are prescribed, the more likely patients are to keep taking them. But previous studies have been too broad to account for differences in diagnoses. For example, when people who received refills kept taking the drug simply because they were still in pain, Delgado says. He and his colleagues limited their study to prescriptions written after ankle sprains to people who had not used an opioid in the previous 6 months. Usually those injuries aren't very serious, and they don't require opioids. About 7% of the 53,000 people who visited ERs with ankle sprains in 2011 and 12 were sent home with an opioid prescription. The researchers found that patients' experiences varied by state. Less than 2% treated in Delaware were prescribed an opioid, compared with about 16% in the state of Mississippi. The research found that the number of pills obtained within a week of those visits also varied greatly, from as few as 5 to more than 60. Typical prescriptions were for 15 to 40 pills. Those who received prescriptions with 30 pills or more were twice as likely to get refills as those with prescriptions for 15 or fewer. And remember, we're talking about ankle sprains primarily here. Well, that's it. That's why we need a non-opioid solution to the pain problem. Okay, let's leave biology for a moment and go to astronomy news. A new May 12th article in the journal Science examines a supergiant exoplanet that seems to have started out differently than the supergiants in our own solar system. Dr. Hannah Wakeford of NASA reports that the Neptune-sized exoplanet, HAT-P26b, has surprisingly low levels of heavy elements in its atmosphere. That result suggests that it formed close to its star. Now that's quite different from how the ice giants in Earth's solar system, Neptune and Uranus, formed. And it suggests possible new insights into different ways planetary systems originate throughout the galaxy. Scientists mostly use computer simulations to try to understand how planetary systems form. And those simulations are based in part on how the planets in Earth's solar system coalesced. But it's unclear how common these types of planetary origins are. Lots of Neptune-sized worlds, for instance, have orbits which are very different than the ice giants of Earth's system. But if the abundance of heavy elements in the atmospheres of exoplanets and other systems resemble the abundances for planets of similar mass closer to home, then those exoplanets were probably created in similar ways. In Earth's solar system, more massive planets have a lower abundance of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. Neptune's abundance of heavy elements is 100 times that of the Sun. Jupiter, 18 times as massive as Neptune, has only 5 times the solar abundance of heavy elements. Neptune's abundance is thought to be higher because it formed farther out, toward the edge of the disk of dust and gas that circled the Sun. There, icy rocks accumulated, which bombarded Neptune and enriched its atmosphere with heavy elements as the rocks disintegrated. Previous studies of 3 exoplanets in separate planetary systems have shown a similar relationship between a planet's mass and its abundance of heavy metals in the atmosphere. To study an exoplanet's atmosphere, the researchers watched the planet pass in front of its parent star, blocking out the star's light. We've discussed this before. A fraction of that starlight gets filtered by the planet's atmosphere, which absorbs some wavelengths of light, giving clues to its composition. Researchers for this paper used the Hubble and the Spitzer space telescopes to study HAT-P26b's atmosphere, and they found a prominent sign of water in visible and infrared wavelengths. From that signature, the team inferred that the exoplanet's atmospheric heavy metal abundance is only 4 to 5 times as much as the Sun's. Wakeford says, quote, "Such a low abundance relative to Neptune's suggests that HAT-P26b formed closer to its star than Neptune did to our Sun. That proximity could have protected the exoplanet from bombardment by bits of icy rock. HAT-P26b, which orbits its star in roughly 4 Earth days, also drew its gas directly from the disk in which the star and planets were forming," unquote. All right, let's end our evening just a little early with our usual sex-related story. If you listened last month, you may remember the creepy story where some researchers were able to build an entire female reproductive system on a chip that could mimic biological cycles of that human system. Well, this month's weird, creepy sex story goes a step further toward the year 6565. Yes, I'm referring to the suicidally depressing song In the Year 2525 by Zagger and Evans. Younglings who have never heard the song, go look it up on YouTube. and you'll become instantly miserable. So what's this story? Scientists have 3D printed functioning ovaries. The journal Nature Communication reports that the first functioning mouse ovaries have been produced by 3D printing by a group of bioengineers at Northwestern University, led by Dr. Teresa Woodruff. Why do we need to have artificially grown ovaries? Well, not all girls grow up to be mothers. Sometimes they choose not to be, and sometimes circumstances take those choices away. Cancer may do it, or a variety of genetic diseases can destroy women's ovaries. Worse, treatments like radiation that are used to save a woman's life can render those egg-producing organs useless. Women may be born with ovaries that do not function. Without them, young patients might never go through puberty and develop properly. Woodruff has reported a possible fix for all of these problems: 3D printed ovaries. Her proof of concept only works on mice so far, but they could end up replacing human ovaries. Woodruff says, quote, "Ovaries are filled follicles. These are immature eggs surrounded by sacs of estrogen and other essential hormones. The function of the ovary is to shepherd these follicles through maturity until fully grown eggs are released every month." Unquote. To create an ovary's function, Woodruff started with the ovary's form. She says, quote, "You tend to think of the skeleton as bones in a body that hold up our flesh, but every type of organ has an extracellular matrix made from stiffer substances that act like scaffolds," unquote. Woodruff's team used chemicals to strip away all the follicles, the blood vessels, and the assorted tissues from a human ovary, leaving only this collagen superstructure. Under the microscope, the scaffold was patterned like an interweaving lattice. Woodruff continues by saying, quote, "The next step was to use ovarian tissue as ink. Yes, using tissue as ink is as difficult as it sounds. Tissue, in our case, is broken down collagen called gelatin. It's possible to squirt it out of a printer, but only if it's at the right temperature. Too hot and the structure sags. Too cold and it clumps. The Goldilocks zone for the tissue ink is about 30 degrees Celsius," unquote. Woodruff's group performs microsurgery pretty frequently. They used magnifying glasses, dissecting scopes, and tiny scalpels, and surgically removed one working ovary from 9 female mice and replaced them with 3D printed prosthetics. 2 of the 9 were controls, whose printed ovaries had no follicles and thus no potential to form embryos. Once the mice had recovered from surgery, the researchers had them mate with male mice. All of these male mice had proven their fertility by fathering previous litters. Well, ta-da! 3 of the females with prosthetic lady parts had babies. All of this happened pretty fast, too. Female mice ovulate every 4 days. Their pregnancies last about 20 days, and those cute little babies are old enough to make babies of their own within 4 months. Woodruff and her team let those babies make babies, and then let those babies make more babies, just to make sure the printed ovaries produce no long-term genetic effects. The process worked perfectly. Additionally, the mothers with the 3D printed organs could nurse normally, which indicated their hormones or their hormone levels were just fine, a good sign for ovary-stricken humans. So, will humans be getting Woodruff's ovaries soon? No, not really, not quite. Woodruff says, quote, "We are very sorry, but humans will have to wait a bit longer. We first have to prove our concept works with larger ovaries. We'll implant those into mini pigs, which have bodies big enough to hold human organs, and similar menstrual cycles to human females," unquote. Woodruff hopes that the little piggy step, along with clinical trials to establish the treatment, is fully safe and effective, and will take less than 5 years. Ovaries are complicated organs, with hormonal connections to the brain and ovulation cycles that require new blood vessels to grow every month. But Woodruff says that they could be good models for other groups working on printed organs. She proposes that these printed ovaries could even be implanted into individuals who are gender dysphoric and have undergone the surgical processes of transition from male to female. Wow. That is frankly going way out on a limb in my opinion, since it's not even clear if these organs work with genetic human females yet. But you gotta respect her ability to think ahead. Good luck, Dr. Woodruff. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Be careful with those ovaries. They're the only ones you got. Keep away from Ethereatol. If you still like bubbly drinks, stick to seltzer water if you're actually worried about it. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.